You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 12th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Timothy Schenck, historian and author of Realigners, Partisan Hacks, Political Visionaries, and the Struggle to Rule American Democracy. Meanwhile, hope is still alive for a fiscal 2023 omnibus spending bill. Although a full year continuing resolution is still on the table as a backup. Friday is the deadline to pass something in order to avert a shutdown. Republican Tom Tillis and Miss Independent, Kyrsten Sinema. Besides all the dependence on corporate money, of course. They're reportedly working on an immigration bill that is pleasing to industry lobbyists and the Chamber of Commerce. So that should say it all. The child tax credit might be returning from the dead, but it's left a piece of itself back on the other side. Biden is reportedly entertaining, including Manchin's work requirements. Still probably won't be enough for Republicans now that they have the House. A new poll shows a majority of Americans don't want Trump to run again, but even more don't want Biden to run for a second term. That is dismal. Carrie Lake is suing, asking the courts to say that she really won the election in Arizona because Maricopa County. Duh. Need I say more? Also in Arizona, Republican Governor Doug Ducey has prioritized stacking shipping containers along the border before leaving office, a move that federal agencies have deemed illegal. The Keystone XL pipeline has predictably ruptured, causing a massive spill in Kansas. Or it's not the Keystone XL, I'm sorry. The Keystone pipeline.
Old-fashioned Keystone.
Yes. The OG. It's the largest crude oil spill in years. A judge has dismissed the criminal charges against former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder over his misconduct in the Flint water crisis. The U.S. government has reportedly made a massive breakthrough after decades and billions of dollars in research. They've reportedly produced a fusion reaction that creates a net energy gain, which could eventually, down the line, revolutionize carbon-free power. And lastly, two have been killed in Peru during protests in which citizens were demanding new elections after the ousting of Pedro Castillo. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. You might be surprised to see me on a Monday, but if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that Sam is on a cruise right now. I am very curious as to how that is going.
Wish we should have had a foghorn sound effect on the sound.
I know, just, yeah, right. And we should wave to him. We should have gone down to wherever he was taking off and waved to him goodbye as if he was,
we
like, setting sail on the
Florida.
Titanic. Yeah, right. In our petticoats and all. I mean, I just can't imagine him in this kind of situation. I'm hoping he documents it, like, and we can have some sort of short film on his experience there, but I feel like cabin fever is like that's a given.
I think the expectation is it'll be unpleasant for him.
Yeah. So, but other than that, we'll get some good stories out of it. So he is out for the week. I will be with you. I heard I missed a fun show on Friday with Benjamin, so check that out. Sam's show from Casual Friday of last week. But also, speaking of Peru, I know some people have been messaging me that they want to have a guest on to talk about Peru. I also agree. We will have someone on tomorrow to break down what is happening in Peru. So check out the... Thursday now? Yeah. Okay, never mind. Thursday instead. I apologize. So Thursday, we'll have a segment on that. Now, I mentioned this in headlines, but there has been a massive oil spill in northeastern Kansas this week, and it was not the Keystone XL pipeline. It was the Keystone pipeline, the OG. The Keystone XL pipeline was thankfully, after years and years of legal wrangling, canceled.
Yeah, and this, just to be clear, like, this Keystone pipeline is not an old pipeline. It was constructed in 2010, basically the first phase of, like, four phases, the fourth of which was the Keystone XL.
Right. And they were attempting to expand their efforts, this company TC Energy. Thankfully, they did not, but you still see that pipelines in general, these are the ramifications.
I mean, I remember this with the Dakota Access Pipeline, and you'd get all these very fancy-sounding environmental impact studies and all these engineers, and they'd be like, oh, trust us, we could operate this pipeline for 100 years and probably not see any sort of significant problem, and it's all just lies. Like, I don't know what else to call it besides you cannot trust experts that are hired by these companies to actually give you an accurate assessment of what the reality is there of environmental impact or risk. And it's really frustrating that we have to deal with that sort of smokescreen BS when we're trying to fight these things. And
it's the exact example of like when we talk about like technocrats and what that obscures, because when Dakota Access Pipeline, you just go there and you see the reliance on the water and where the path for the pipeline was supposed to go. And you're like, this is physically impossible that it's not going to impact the water almost immediately. And with Keystone, there have been, I think, like 24 or something like that, previous spills from this pipeline, which, as you say, Matt, started in 2010. And so it's been averaging well over...
started pumping in 2013. So it's like it's only been going for...
at least 2 a year. And if my terrible math, I know that, you know, I'm lowballing it even there. But this spill has been just so disastrous, the largest in nearly a decade, in 9 years, and by far the biggest from Keystone, from the Keystone pipeline. Here's some footage of that. If you're listening on the podcast, I will describe what we're seeing. So this is from a few days ago.
I mean, it looks like a fireball or like a comet.
Right.
Went over this area. It's just like a giant black streak. And
here's Mill Creek. It's a water source that runs past this. It looks like a black ink stain. TC Energy estimates nearly 600,000 gallons of oil escaped. This is, by the way, footage from Nebraska Public Media. Here's some more.
Yeah, and shout out to all the, especially like the Prairie Public Media. I know North Dakota has good public media and stuff to support those sorts of organizations. Like if you're in Nebraska, throw a donation to Nebraska Public Media's way for doing this.
And here they're describing that the amount of oil fills an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Just some more footage here.
Just wild. Just a complete... I mean,
blotting out of of this whole hillside here, and you could see earlier some vehicles down there for scale, but right.
And it's like they're just going to move on from that, and you know they'll try to do some things to like make it look aesthetically a little bit less of a complete like apocalypse.
Right.
I also recommend a book by Catherine Wiltenberg Todres, Black Snake, Standing Rock, The Dakota Access Pipeline and Environmental Justice.
Yes.
And it talks about like this, I mean, really dark historical irony where like these indigenous people, particularly like the Lakota and Dakota, had this myth of the black snake, and then you see us putting these pipelines that do that to the environment, and you think like, maybe they're onto something about what we were going to bring to this country.
Right. And, yeah, so, by the way, Kowalski just wrote in and said, we actually got very lucky with the timing of this oil spill due to the massive drought. Its ability to pollute the water supply was medicated significantly.
Oh, wow.
That is good news. But, you know, as... can't count on that luck every time.
Yeah.
And this is going to be brushed under the rug.
Hey, that's good news about droughts, is when the oil pipes burst, they won't get into the water.
Yeah, it's a silver lining for the ramifications of our environmental crisis. So just some visual imagery for you about what we're doing to our planet currently. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We have some ad reads from our sponsors that Sam has for you, and then we will get to Timothy Schenck, historian professor at George Washington University and author of Realigners, Partisan Hacks, Political Visionaries, and the Struggle to Rule American Democracy. Be right back.
Hey, folks, a couple words from our sponsors today. First sponsor is an organization or website, really, that I use to find some of the charities that this time of year I give to, including Give Directly. We had them on a couple of weeks ago. And I found them through givewell.org. What is givewell.org? Well, they spend over 30,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funding to a few of the highest impact evidence-based opportunities they've found. Look, this time of year, you want to give, a lot of people start thinking about giving to charities. You want to make sure that the charity you're giving to is both, you know, reputable, many of them are, but you also want to make sure that the way that they're deploying their funds has some real impact. Very hard to figure out how to decide that. Well, this is where givewell.org comes in. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. I am one of them. I have been for 3 or 4 years, maybe more, actually, pre-COVID, I feel like. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations are going to save over 150,000 lives and improve the lives of literally millions more. And using GiveWell's research, this is the thing, is completely free. And it's not only free to you, it is free to the charities that GiveWell.org points you to. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. There's no sign-up required, nothing. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity or fund that you choose without taking a cut. So this is a great portal for you to find the best charities in terms of evidence-backed sort of return on your dollar, essentially. This is the way that I give to Give Directly because both it helps support GiveWell.org, which is doing a great service for people who want to give money to charities, and it's really helpful for those charities that have proven they are the most sort of like effective charities out there. If you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities, and this is the time to do it, you can have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of this year, or as long, of course, as the matching funds last. So to claim your match, go to givewell.org, pick podcast, enter Majority Report at checkout. That way they'll know that you heard about GiveWell from the Majority Report, and they will do the matching donation. So check it out. It is givewell.org. When you go into how you heard about givewell.org, select podcast, Majority Report, enter it in there at checkout, and you will get your $100 matched as long as those funds last. Givewell.org. Also, our sponsor today, with me just about every day, except for on the rare occasion I forget, and then I freak out, and then I have somebody to do it for me, Liquid IV. One thing that might be missing from your daily routine, hydration. Particularly, I find it surprising, in the winter, I get dehydrated because the heat in our buildings is, I don't really have the ability to adjust it, is the most dry heat in the world. And Liquid IV saves the day. Now, of course, I drink it every day during the show. In one stick, you get 5 essential vitamins. You're hydrating 2 times faster than water alone. Liquid IV, you get 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. It's also non-GMO. It is free from gluten. It is free from dairy. It is free from soy. Liquid IV also, as a company, is on a mission to change the world. To date, the company has donated over 25 million servings in 50-plus countries around the world. Things I love about Liquid IV, particularly when you're traveling, they're little packets. You can put them in your suitcase. Super easy. They have great flavors. This is the this one's got some extra vitamins in it. It's the immune support, tangerine flavor, but I also like the matcha that gives you a little bit extra energy. I'll drink the Concord. I'll drink the pina colada. I'll drink the watermelon in the summer. I don't know why I'm so specific about that being a summer drink, but they've got all sorts of flavors too. It's delicious. And again, this is good for post-pre-workout. It is good if you've overindulged the night before. It is good if you're traveling and you don't want to get dehydrated. It's just good on a daily basis. I drink practically a bottle of this every day, at least sometimes two. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco or get 20% off. You shop better hydration at liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. Not Majority Report, MAJORITYREP. That's 20% off anything at liquidiv.com with the code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Check it out. All right, back to Emma and more of the show.
Back.
We are back. We are back, and we are joined now by Tim Schenck. Tim is a historian, professor at George Washington University, and author of Realigners, Partisan Hacks, Political Visionaries, and the Struggle to Rule American Democracy. Tim, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Anna.
Of course. So your book really looks at the history of the United States through moments of realignment, as your title suggests, and also the majorities that were central to those moments of realignment and the people that were kind of representative of those majorities or leaders in certain ways. It's easy to see how the Trump election might have inspired you, but why did you decide to broaden the scope to just like American history generally?
Well, part of it was just the shock of the moment. You know, I started really thinking about what this book would look like the day after the election in 2016, just because at the time I had just finished doing a PhD in American history, especially focused on American political history, and I was just gobsmacked by what happened. So kind of out of shame and frustration that I felt like I should have known better, and I wanted to get a handle on what had happened. And the more I dug into the reading and the research for it, the more I came to think that at least one fundamental part of the story about how someone like Trump gets elected in the first place is a broader frustration with how the system works. And I came to think that so much of that frustration comes from the fact that neither party has majority, which means it's so hard to get things done, which leads to this really weird feeling, I think, that characterizes politics today, where it simultaneously feels like everything is falling apart, but nothing ever gets done. And I think that if there's hope for breaking out of that terrible cycle, then figuring out how to build a large, durable majority, and by my lights, it'd be a lot better if that was a large, durable, progressive majority, is an essential first step.
Yeah. And I mean, what was so interesting about your book, too, is that I never thought of it in the way that you describe how for like a majority of American history, there really was, for decades, there would be one party that would be largely the dominating force, and you had party that it gave rise to party machines, and it was largely dependent on that, as opposed to like the era of, I guess, the activist class, which you talk about as well. Where do you think that split really begins to happen in the 20th century?
Well, and one thing to say is that I think you and I feel this way. That's like, it's kind of shocking to realize that there were once big majorities that roamed the land like dinosaurs, because we've grown up in a time when it's just so characterized by division, and it's so hard to think that we could get beyond the sort of game of inches that politics has turned into. But yeah, this is why history is helpful, as we step back and see that, wow, our own experience in our lifetimes, the thing that's so easy to take for granted, it is really strange. And the moment where the wheels start to come off the bus in a major way, if you had to pick one, I would say 1968. That's a moment when the last great majority in American politics, which was the New Deal coalition that elected FDR so many times and a Democratic Congress also importantly so many times, that really starts to crumble. And since then, it's been a story about Republicans trying to put together a lasting majority, being able to do it for a while at the presidential level, but not being able to back it up in Congress. Then by the time they get Congress under control in 94, Clinton's in office, and both parties increasingly get to the space where elections are decided by these narrower and narrower margins so that a handful of districts and a handful of states have this wildly outsized influence on who gets to wield power. But because those majorities are so small, what politicians can actually do is really limited in the moment. And then there's a really good chance that the other side will take over and just undo most of that anyway.
But I guess also what is so important to informing that dynamic is the rise of neoliberal ideology and kind of like the unfettered capitalism just taking control. I mean, I feel like that creates perhaps some of the instability that you describe.
Absolutely. But this is the thing. So like one thing to mention about me is I'm co-editor of Dissent, a left-wing magazine. I'm very proud to say it's the longest running democratic socialist magazine in the country. If I could pin the blame all on neoliberalism, nothing would make me happier. But the problem is when I say that, so, okay, so you can see this process really underway by 1968. You know, 1968 is not the peak of the New Deal, but it's also not 1978. It's not 1988.
Right.
It's not the zenith of the sort of neoliberal turn. So I think neoliberalism makes things worse in lots of ways, but it does it in complicated ways, and it's not the only factor at play. Ironically, part of the story is the success of the New Deal itself, which lifts lots of people from the working class into the middle class, and when you take away that sort of hard edge of economic insecurity, there's loads of political science research to show that, well, people, when you put a little more money in the pocket, all of a sudden they might not care about those pocketbook issues as much, and they might care about other issues, ranging from abortion to religion to anything else that gets shorthanded as part of the culture war. That stuff can loom into the ground more, partly because the New Deal is so successful. Again, this isn't to excuse neoliberalism, but to say that there's a really complicated story here about the way that culture and economics fit together.
Absolutely. Let's actually, I want to get back to that once we kind of move through history and get more modern. But I am fascinated by these different moments of realignment that you speak about in your book. We can start early on with the early days of the country when Jeffersonians were that was much more dominant. Created a period of realignment after that one, like at least in terms of the ruling class, the people in government, there was much broader consensus than ended up being the case.
Yeah. So the book really, it starts with the Constitution, the drafting of the Constitution. And the reason why is you have to understand the laws written in our Constitution, I think more than anything, their most lasting effect and why the system is so stable is one, at a time when and even the sort of modest democracy of the kind that existed back then, where it's enfranchisement mostly for white dudes who meet a basic property threshold, that's still a radical democratic term compared to the global norm at the time. But two, that the system lasts. We have the Constitution today. We have this system, not so much because of checks and balances or the stuff that people learn about in social studies, but just because resting a government on the authority of the people, on the consent of the governed, that turns out to be a really, really effective way of guaranteeing legitimacy for the system. But the thing that the founders hoped would happen, one, they did want that legitimacy. They want to say, okay, if we can't have a king to point to, we need to have the people. But they really hoped the people would shut up between elections. The idea was that they would empower what was called a natural aristocracy. And in fact, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the last few years about the Electoral College and all the problems with it, including, I think, in lefty circles that I run in, a sense that, well, one of the big knocks against the Electoral College is that it's established to protect slavery, that it's soaked in white supremacy. It's like, as with so much else in American history. And to my mind, that's actually not a cynical enough reading of the Electoral College, because if you go back to the constitutional debates in 1787, you see James Madison saying, like, listen, like, Electoral College will be fine, but we can have a president be elected by popular vote. That's fine, too. Like, why is Madison fine with a popular vote in 1787? Because he says, in so many words, that the people will just naturally defer to their betters, so that the more people you have voting, the more this natural aristocracy will just rise to the top, so we won't have to worry. And this is the great hope, again, that people will just say, natural aristocrats, doing a good job, keep going, and pipe down between elections. The thing that changes in the 1790s is that those natural aristocrats fall into a kind of civil war between themselves. So you have a broad, vicious fight that breaks out between Hamiltonians called Federalists and supporters of Thomas Jefferson, James Madison being one of them. And the way that this political elite discovers to settle this civil war within itself, it's this astonishing innovation. Oh, those people who are supposed to shut up, they can be the tiebreakers in this battle. So if we go to the polls, if we win elections, if we persuade them, then that allows us to rule in their name. Because it turns out the natural aristocracy is not going to agree, but within this debate inside the ruling class, it can be settled by appealing to the public. Now, the great thing that will happen over the next 200 years is that the conversation opens up beyond that ruling class, but that initial first step is so important for setting the stage for what's to come.
Tim, I can't tell you how refreshing it is to have a guest on this program who shares my cynicism or maybe my contempt, at least. I'll characterize it as contempt for me, for people who try to make the Constitution and its intent into like a biblical text, one that is meant to create like broad democratic outcomes as opposed to ones that serve the people who actually wrote that piece of text, just like any other piece of text or governmental constitution. It just is. Those things can improve, but you have to look at things with a critical eye. It's better than others, but that is exactly how you describe.
Yeah, and this is, I think that the best way to understand it is just, as with American democracy itself, these are the rules of the game. And if we want to get power, if we want to use that power to make the world a better place, we have to understand those rules. But we can't afford to be naive in either perspective, I think, especially if you're advocating on behalf of the powerless, of people who the system is already rigged against. Then I think we just need to have a brutal realism about what the limits that are being placed on our capacity to move are, but also how we can actually affect change.
So let's you talk about that shift then in the 1790s. Do you mind just taking us to the next realignment, how that begins to play out, where those cracks begin to form?
Great. So this is the 1820s, what I think a lot of people will know as Jacksonian democracy, as in Andrew Jackson. And a couple big turns happen here. One is that if you want to date the emergence of populism, Andrew Jackson, not bad as representative of this. He is in some sense very much a creature of the establishment. He's a wealthy slave owner who at the time was a senator, but he's also clearly not cut from the same mold of the American elite as the person he beats in 1828, John Quincy Adams, who is just groomed to take over, groomed to be one of those natural aristocrats from birth on, essentially. And Jackson has his face, the sort of the rural white man taking back power from this northeastern natural aristocracy. That's part of the story. But another really, really important part is the making up, what you alluded to earlier, these sort of party machines that turn partisan conflict into a forever game. Because yes, the founders in the 1790s, they accepted the idea that you need to fight out over parties for a while. You need to appeal to the public for a while. But they hoped that it was kind of a fever that would break eventually. So it was a phase country would go through. You'd have these parties, but then it would be done. Now, the great innovation that not so much Andrew Jackson, but this contingent of partisan operatives and maneuverers. Martin Van Buren is someone who's kind of forgotten today, but it's sort of the Karl Rove of the 1830s and of the Jacksonian era. He's the guy pulling the strings behind the scenes. He's the one who says, among others, that, all right, if we want to win for the long term, and he thinks of himself as a kind of defending the people. He says like, oh yeah, I want to take on that Hamiltonian ghost. He sees himself as a Democrat in the Jeffersonian tradition, but he says, what we need to do if we're going to win is to have these permanent party machines, and we need to build a national majority. And the key thing for building that national majority is basically getting New York and Virginia, which are the two biggest states in the country at the time. We need to get both of them into the same camp, which means focusing on these issues where we can build a broad alliance of white guys, and therefore also keeping slavery out of the conversation as much as possible, because that is the one thing that's guaranteed to blow out the system. Now, the amazing irony is that about 20 years later, Martin Van Buren will, in a kind of protest move, run as the presidential nominee for the Free Soil Party, which is a crucial step in mainstreaming anti-slavery sentiment. They basically come up with a Republican Party platform, what Abraham Lincoln will run on 12 years before Lincoln actually wins. But that transition from Jacksonian democracy to this anti-slavery political revolution, weirdly, a coalition that's built so much out of defending white male supremacy ends up contributing to undermining it in the most profound way.
And the national appeal element, right, where you're trying to build a broad coalition, on its face, I feel like a lot of people would say I'm on board with that, right? But do you mind just expanding a little bit more on what perverse incentives that created, in addition to, you know, the slavery piece that you just described?
It just all makes hard choices across the board, so that when you are trying to build a coalition, you always have to think about what its purpose is going to be. And you have to recognize that there's never one national majority out there waiting to be made. That Jacksonian coalition was dominant for a while, but it was able to, it was destroyed, it was overthrown in the 1850s when you saw the emergence of a new type of majority, which wasn't this cross-sectional North-South alliance, but Republicans coming together to build a majority solely out of northern free states. But what happens when you do that is inevitably that means you're pushing some issues to the foreground, some issues to the background. And one issue that Martin Van Buren was very concerned about in his dying days when he sees the Civil War erupting, something that he opposed, was that he fears that with the triumph of this anti-slavery cause, that the sort of class struggle that he saw himself as a kind of participant in, that that's going to go to the back burner. Now, there were lots of Republicans in 1860s who thought, no, by overthrowing the slave power in the South, we'll do the most that we can defend economic equality across the country. But the great tragedy of the 19th century is that out of this extraordinary triumph of abolition, civil war, emancipation, and this sort of short-lived experiment in multiracial democracy called Reconstruction, that lasts for a while, but it ends really quickly. So that by the 1880s, the country, which had seemed as if it was on the path to such a better place circa 1865, has dead-ended between the Gilded Age and Jim Crow. And this sort of next turn of the wheel, if the story of Jacksonian democracy ends with kind of an unexpected hope with the Civil War, the story of this radical Republican moment ends with just this brutal tragedy of Jim Crow and the Gilded Age.
The incentives of, I'm sorry to keep returning to this, but it just has my brain working. Like, the is popularism as like defined in our modern era, like a version of that kind of theory of power that I think sometimes can further marginalize already marginalized people because their issues are not necessarily the ones that, if you are guided by a poll, that will be prioritized.
Yeah, and the most basic way you can say this is that there's always going to be a kind of tension between democracy and liberalism. If you define democracy as majority rule and liberalism as above all concerned with minority rights. And those would be the rights, you know, historically, this was, it ranged, sort of some of the first liberals, the minority rights they were most concerned about were the rights of people with money. You know, they say there's a tiny number of people who have a lot of money. This is something that's very much on the table of the Constitutional Convention. They're like, if we have this democratic system, how do we make sure that all the people without money don't gang up and take it from the people who do have money, that small number at the top. But they're also concerned with the rights of religious minorities. And eventually, radical Republicans will be concerned with rights of African Americans as well. So perennially, there's going to be a tension over how you defend minority rights, especially, you know, for a progressive today, concerns about racial justice. That's going to be so at the center of the debate throughout the 20th century. How do you reconcile that with democracy? And the people who I find most inspiring are the ones who face up to this problem and come up with a way to defend those rights of people who of the powerless and advance their interests while doing it in a way that draws out the best of the American democratic tradition, which I think is there. And so to get to the question of popularism, I think you could say that there are kind of two faces of popularism. There's one that says, listen, let's just take a poll and figure out exactly where the country is right now and just try to pivot to the center in every respect. And that is a good way to win elections, probably not a great way to change the country. The other, you could say, is a more ambitious version, which says, let's take what the public thinks seriously, but also figure out where are the issues, where are they on the issues that matter to us, and how can we change them to bring them onto our side? So what are the sections where the public is leaning in our direction, where we can bring them toward us and use it as the basis for a coalition that can push out transformative change across the board?
So let's now turn then to this, I guess, the third realignment pattern here, and that is the Republicans under Lincoln and beyond during the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Really, absolutely. So this is a high point for him. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So this is the character, by the way, something I should mention is that in the book, one thing I tried to do is instead of just telling this as a story of, which political scientists often do, it kind of, okay, here are the spreadsheets that explain who voted what, here's the precinct by precinct breakdown. Something I try to put the emphasis on is on the ideas and the people who push those into the foreground. And the character that I use here is another figure who's kind of forgotten today, but was so important in his lifetime. This Senator Charles Sumner, who was senator from Massachusetts, elected in the 1850s, and during his lifetime really seen as the leading white advocate for racial equality in American politics. He goes as far in a kind of anti-racism of the 1860s direction as you could possibly go at the time. He says that stamping out the word white from our statute books is the goal of his life. And at a time when it seems so completely marginal, so impossible to build an anti-slavery majority in the United States, something that both abolitionists and people who oppose slavery but don't put it at the center of their lives, like Abraham Lincoln, for instance, in the 1840s, at a time when almost nobody believes that anti-slavery could turn into a viable political cause, he's kind of an example of that, almost a radical version of popularism, which says, I see how we can build a northern free state majority to destroy what he calls the slave power, which is his great enemy. Again, the problem that he'll run into is that destroying the slave power by itself isn't enough to bring about the broader social and economic transformation, which he sees as really guaranteeing the rights to equality that are enshrined in, or at least the faith in equality that's enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. But in his lifetime, if nothing else, he stands for the notion that some of those beliefs, which seem so radical and so marginal at one moment, can become not just common sense, but seeming inevitabilities almost within the blink of an eye by historical standards.
Yeah, I mean, I did want to flesh out that part of your book, how you highlight politicians and activists as a bit of a lens to view these different moments in history. I mean, if we don't mind, I'd love to move to the New Deal here, because, like, I mean, here on the show, we've talked a lot about the Civil War and Reconstruction, but you know, what is fascinating there is the dynamic you described earlier about how that kind of being after that period, the moment that things fall apart, because Reconstruction informs that as well, right? And the failure there.
Yep, the failure of Reconstruction really does help set the stage for both Jim Crow and the Gilded Age, right? It's no coincidence that the collapse of this ambitious project in multiracial democracy, in a sense, it's defeated by both white supremacy in the South and by a resurgent capitalist class that's very happy that the slave power is out of the way so that they can then extend across the rest of the country. And one thing that happens in the 1870s and 1880s is that this northern free state majority that had once driven a political revolution against slavery just becomes a way of defending the status quo, because both Republicans and Democrats, and to a significant degree, instead of confronting the facts of this country that's going through this wrenching transition to industrial capitalism, a period when the United States has some of the most ferocious class conflict of any country in the world, instead of running elections about that, there's a lot of attempts basically to refight the Civil War and to just have this argument again about the North and the South, and Republicans can win elections by waving the bloody shirt, which is just reminding people that the South was on the bad side in the Civil War. You want to stand by us now. And Democrats can do the same thing in the South just to reverse it. And the extraordinary moment that comes about because of the Great Depression is that it's part of a longer process of getting the country over the electoral divisions of the Civil War so that you get under FDR, that's sort of the strongest and strangest coalition in American history, which is literally an alliance that stretches from black communists in Harlem down to unreconstructed KKK white supremacists in the South. As then FDR carries Harlem in 1936 by a significant number, very unusual for Democrats, at the same time that he wins South Carolina by literally 99% of the vote.
Is this like the last really major realignment before we begin to see the era of polarization?
So it's the last, and it's unless you want to talk about a realignment as the breakdown of this last big majority. And it's also the strange, and one reason I say it's the strangest majority in American history is not just sort of the incongruity between that Harlem to Jim Crow alliance, but also because this is the only time in American history where the parties are reliably divided on along economic lines, so that if you're working class, there's a really good chance that you're a Democrat. If you're upper class, there's a really good chance you're a Republican. And it's squishy in between, but again, tilted toward, like, income ties up with partisan preferences pretty reliably, not universally, but pretty reliably. And just a striking thing is that for the rest of American history, the parties usually, they're not divided along those economic lines. It's more this sort of crazy quilt of sometimes it's economics, sometimes it's culture defined broadly. It can be region, it can be religion, it can be race, it can be lots of stuff. but the system that's normally very messy becomes unusually economically clear in this period. So yes, it's the New Deal coalition. To me, it's so fascinating. One, because it's that last big majority, and two, because it's so exceptional for featuring this economic division strongly, which is just runs against the norm of American history.
How did World War II affect your perception of how America was aligned or unaligned in the period leading before the break you talked about at the start of this in 60?
Yeah, it's part of a broader transition that's happening. It's already underway and will accelerate after, where it's a lot of that sort of radical promise of the 1930s really starts to fade. And there are a bunch of different reasons behind that. But the result is that the hope that Democrats could become a sort of truly radical labor party, which does not seem insane in the 1930s, and that this will therefore allow a sort of broader transformation of American politics for lots of reasons, that's gone by 1950. And instead, you have a sense of Democrats, yeah, they can win elections, but it'll just be, instead of a vehicle for some profound transformation, just a general defense of a status quo that, luckily, from my perspective, is tilted more in favor of the working class than it was before, but it's not going to be a road to somewhere drastically different. So this sort of 1-2 punch of first World War II, then the Cold War, along with just this already starting to see sort of breakdowns in those strong economic divisions in the 1930s, put it together, and you have a recipe for a more kind of complacent politics in the 1950s than you saw in the 1930s.
Was that also in part due to the fact that the New Deal, for all its like incredible achievements, was in many ways designed to preserve capitalism, where people did feel that there was like some crumbling happening?
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of, it's as FDR and some of the New Dealers complain, you know, why are these capitalists opposing us? We're doing everything we can to save capitalism. If they knew that it was in their best interest, they would be the biggest supporters of what we're up to. Yeah, they do a good enough job of rescuing the system from the brink of catastrophe so that we don't have the need for more radical alternatives. But as always, I never want to let Democrats off the hook. You know, I can be broadly sympathetic to their side of the argument, but I think we have to be, again, clear-eyed about how they contribute to their own problems. And one, I don't want to go as far as to say villain, but I maybe would say my least favorite non-slaveholding politician in American history is Adlai Stevenson, who is this darling for liberals in the 1950s, but I see as like pretty atrocious across the board on issues from economics to racial justice, name it. And he just comes to stand for like a liberalism of like the fancy pants, basically, where it's like, oh, he's so thoughtful, he's so intellectual, he's so sophisticated. But if you try and pin him down on any issue that seemingly matters, from labor rights to segregation and integration, he gets awfully squirrely really, really fast. And the emergence of a sort of affluent, suburbified, educated, cosmopolitan Democratic Party, which is so important today and has brought a lot of good with it, I think you can see the problems that they'll run into already in the rise of a figure like Stevenson, who, among other things, just gets like shellacked twice by Dwight Eisenhower. And you can already see in the 1950s the breakdown of that working class coalition that had been so important, not just for FDR, but for Harry Truman, who in 1948 wins re-election against the odds by bringing that New Deal coalition together for one last spin while putting questions about racial equality much more to the center than FDR had, but also not letting up as a defender of labor.
So now we're nearing the end of the 1960s. The machine influence, the party machines that you describe, it's changing in form. It's changing in the way that it needs to appeal to people. And it creates you describe an activist class, and then an activist class machine. So that replaces it. Who are they? How do you define that class?
Yeah. So this is the rise of the Emmas and Tims of the world, for better and for worse, right? So this is especially sort of the college educated folks who, as it's described by some really astute observers at the time, they stand in for this new type of political actor who, instead of like the machine oriented partisan operatives of yore who cared about patronage and wanted to win elections because that was a direct way to power, these folks, they care more about causes. You know, they've gone to school, they've learned to believe in things, and they've learned to believe that American politics could be a vehicle for that type of transformation. And there's a lot to admire about that. But as exemplified by the fact that this is, you know, the class that you and I are both part of. But a problem is what emerges over time is that you see on both the left and the right, there's a Democratic version of this and a Republican version of this, where those activist classes, which I really do think they start out with the best of intentions, they become a new type of establishment of their own. And this is something that, you know, I live outside Washington, D.C. I teach at GW, see it every day. If you're in New York, there's its own version of this, a sort of permanent activist establishment that needs to get money from donors in order to stay alive, but doesn't need to win elections in the same way. And you can have this sort of unmooring from what the rest of the country thinks because you're off in your world where it's, you know, maybe the 5 to 10% of the population that treats politics as a hobby and doesn't have the same type of skin in the game as earlier political groups did. Like, one way you could shorthand the sort of broader transformation of the parties that this stands in for is that back in the 1950s, Democrats more or less were the party of the AFL and Republicans were the party of the Chamber of Commerce. Today, I think it's fair to say Democrats are the party of MSNBC and Republicans the party of Fox News. And as someone who agrees with the substance of a lot of what those MSNBC show hosts have to say a good chunk of the time, this isn't the worst thing in the world to me, but it comes with sacrifices. And I think if we want to get out of the trap that American politics has become, we need to have, again, this sort of clear-eyed recognition of what the trade-offs have been.
I mean, and in the birth of the activist class, I feel that it's, well, one, it begins the culture war, as you write about, or as we define it now. But also, I mean, someone you focused on in particular, and someone who I think is immensely important in American history, particularly as a woman, and if you're looking at feminism, is Phyllis Schlafly, and you highlight her as well. She's a really good example of this kind of personality taking hold and building coalitions that conservatives have to respond to. And then, of course, that there are others on the left. But in my opinion, it's really been tilted to that other side, increasingly so since the 60s, since this period. Do you mind talking about her in particular?
Absolutely. No, she's a fascinating character. And like, the book really clicked for me when I came to feel like that there was a kind of kinship between Charles Sumner in the 1850s and Phyllis Schlafly in the 1950s, where, you know, which is a really strange comparison, which I definitely not would have come up with
strange
before.
Strange bedfellows, yes.
Yeah, but you do see, again, sort of an orientation, but for better or worse, these are people who took these causes that seemed like they were on the fringes of American life and managed to build majorities around them, or at least help contribute to this process of building majorities. And this is, again, we get to like the radical side of a kind of popularism where instead of just saying we'll win elections by taking the status quo as it is and just going to where voters are now, thinking about ways that you can build a new type of majority, which involves reckoning with what people think, but also trying to change their minds. Like, that stands for something. And again, I would rather the majority that was built, not the one that Phil Schlafly wanted. But I think if we want to defeat the system that she helped make, we have to understand how it was built in the first place. And it was built by people who are just candidly brilliant, like Schlafly, because what she sees early on, and this is really the through line in her politics. You know, you and I, we might know her chiefly as the sort of Cate Blanchett vehicle for the Hulu Phyllis Schlafly show, like Mrs. America or whatever, and which is a not bad show. But it sort of treats Schlafly as just why she matters is that she's the face of anti-feminism in the 1970s. But in order to understand what she was up to in the 70s, you have to see that as just one chapter in this larger career, which for her was devoted single-mindedly to the pursuit of what she described it as victory for the grassroots over the kingmakers. And for her, the grassroots was this face of this sort of middle American, not so implicitly white majority that she thought stood for the country as a whole against this Yankee Northeastern liberal establishment that she thought was able to control both parties. And what she sees early on is that by leaning into a handful of those divisive social issues that really start to emerge to the foreground in the 1960s and never go away for the rest of her life, which runs into 2016 when she is dying of cancer but campaigning for Donald Trump, who she loves, what Schlafly sees is that those social issues can be basically a sledgehammer that she'll use to help destroy the New Deal coalition, and then try and build something new. Now, she never gets quite the majority that she wanted, but she at least succeeds in the part of abolishing the old system.
Well, what is old is new again, because, I mean, you talk about the fact that she was still active until her death in conservative politics, but everything you describe there is what Tucker Carlson says on a nightly basis on Fox News, and so that has remained almost remarkably consistent. I feel like that is what Republican politics have been in this country for decades at this point.
That's the astonishing thing. Honestly, for me, reading the Schlafly stuff was by the latest at the 90s and in some key ways going back to the 1950s, seeing the core of a Tucker Carlson right-wing populist agenda already laid out there. But the way I want to flip that back is, for our side, if this stuff has been around for so long, why haven't we come up with a better response to it?
Wow.
Or, you know, one that's able to deal with what I think are like some legitimate concerns that a lot of people who do feel economically frustrated, who do feel that they're left economically and culturally isolated, who do feel as if the system isn't speaking for them. You know, a lot of those voters were once the backbone of the New Deal coalition. And I think that if we're going to have a progressive majority that's strong enough to push through lasting change, we need to figure out a way to communicate with them and to be heard in a way that we're not.
Well, right, we need now to embrace the labor movement. I mean, that's what the Democratic Party needs to do and has rejected for decades. I mean, I feel that's just my opinion. I wonder what yours is, if that is a huge element of why the vacuum is left for this kind of stuff.
I think we start there. But again, I don't think we can end there, because if you go back to the 50s and the 60s, when you can already see this coalition starting to fray, the frustrating thing is like that is the peak of labor power in the United States. So that this the phenomenon, which was reported on at the time and maybe overreported, but not zero, of good labor union voters supporting George Wallace in 1968, that requires sort of a more comprehensive strategy, I think. And one of the figures who ended up being, in a kind of way, both like really inspiring and depressing for me, was thinking about Barack Obama in this context. Because my favorite research find in the book was this long manuscript, 250 pages, that Barack Obama co-wrote when he was in law school with his best friend at the time, who's an economist, also at Harvard, where young Obama lays out basically a playbook for transforming American politics. And he says the core of it is figuring out a way to get that New Deal coalition back on its feet. And he says that having a strong economic message has to be part of the story, but that we also, I mean, this is Obama who's coming out of having spent years as a community organizer in Chicago. He says that if there's a majority coalition that's worth defending, it'll be because it brings transformative change to the people I was working with on the South Side, sort of overwhelmingly Black, overwhelmingly poor, disempowered group. And the great gambit that he has, he's going to make in 1991, is that I can be part of a process that will build a majority that will deliver real change for those people. And I think the tragedy is that, again, it's a recurring theme for me, that the hope doesn't live, the sort of results don't deliver on those initial expectations. But I think that Obama at this early moment, running through a good chunk of his career, he's tapping into something that's really strong in American history. And why it ended up being, I go back and forth on Obama, sort of the limit, the excitement of what was promised, the limits of what was achieved. But what he stands for at his best and what he saw at his most astute, I think can be the basis for a majority that, along with defending labor, is able to put up a broader agenda that can get that realigned, can help deliver that political realignment, which again, I think is just a precondition for getting out of the doom loop that we've been trapped in for the last few years.
Final question here. Returning to now, since we've moved along the timeline with great efficiency here, what are some of the realignment trends that you're seeing today?
So a lot of them are disturbing, right? And luckily, right, the 2022 election wasn't as much of a bloodbath as I've been afraid of. But what we've seen over the last decade or so is this continued flight of, at first, white working class voters, but now more broadly sort of working class voters of color, especially Latino voters, away from the Democratic Party. It's not a disaster. It's not a nightmare. It's not Republicans have become the party of the working class. No. But it is a recipe for a jumble. And especially when it's combined with now sort of recurring struggles of Democrats to generate high African-American turnout of the kind that they became accustomed to during the Obama years, especially in 2008 and 2012. So that somewhere between disillusionment with working class voters across the board to a retreat to Republicans. To me, this seems like what should be the number one item on the Democratic agenda if we want to, and not just Democratic agenda, but the left agenda more broadly, if we see Democrats as, for all their flaws, the best vehicle for putting through the type of changes that can make this country a fairer, more equal place where power and money is taken out of the hands of a very small number of people and given to a much larger number. Now, the hope that you see here is that the combination of Republicans going insane on issues like election denialism, combined with smart campaigning from Democrats ranging from John Fetterman to Gretchen Whitmer, shows that the battle isn't over yet. But I think the first step is going to be recognizing that there's a battle to be fought and that should be taken seriously, not just because we have to win elections in order to stop Republicans, though I think we do, but we have to win elections in order to earn the right to change the country for the better.
Tim Schenck, a historian professor at George Washington University, author of Realigners, Partisan Hacks, Political Visionaries, and The Struggle to Rule American Democracy, I should also say, of Dissent Magazine, a great magazine as well. Tim, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was fantastic.
It was great. Thanks. All right, folks, with that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program, and we will head into the fun half shortly. We'll be taking your calls. We'll be talking Elon Musk, getting booed. Fun for the whole family. 646-257-3920. But first, Matt, what is happening on Left Reckoning?
This weekend, we did another of our viewing series of the Tucker Carlson original documentaries on Fox Nation, which I had a 7-day free trial to, so I recorded the videos through OBS. And we watched Tucker Carlson's End of Men documentary and talked a little bit about how there actually is a real problem there. And even some of the things Tucker says, like about like sperm counts or something, well, maybe they may be a bit apocalyptically delivered, are concerning, but would point to a strengthened EPA and financing public schools so that they can have good phy-ed programs. Instead, he turns it to tan your nuts and drink a lot of eggs out of a glass.
Oh, very, very manly.
And it has something to do with nationalism. So we, with a deep state Cuba of This Is Revolution, got into that and watched quite a bit of it. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to access that. I also just want to plug for folks who want a little bit closer perspective on the Matt Taibbi Twitter files thing. Radio War Nerd is a podcast that has people who've worked with Taibbi, and I would recommend their most recent episode on that, not only for Mark Ames and Yasha and Gary's perspective on Taibbi, but also Yasha's perspective on being in Russia at the time where they started the immobilization up recently. And it's a good you have to pay for it, but it's a good podcast.
All right, yeah, check that out. Today on ESPN at 4 p.m., we will be talking about this week in the NFL. The Detroit Lions have arrived. It's really fun. Hard not to root for the Lions right now. And I was right about Tua. I was also right about Mike White. And if you want to debate me, call in during the show today, because I was right, and I continue to be right that Justin Herbert was better than Tua. Also, we'll do some World Cup previews. That's all. 646-257-3920. Oh, and youtube.com/ESPN show. I'm just poking the bear today, Bradley. I mean, I hope you're okay with that. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Nightmare!
Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black.
and the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.